so excited to welcome you to Real Woman, Real Torah, a project of Bacheva Learning Center. We're here to offer you an authentic Torah learning experience, produced for woman, by woman. I hope you enjoy.
I think we've all had this experience of getting very emotionally excited or passionate about something, or, you know, feeling extremely inspired or motivated. And I think the nature of emotions in general is that they're fleeting. They change very quickly. We could feel very, very intensely one way in one moment, and then it dissipates. And, you know, a day, a week, a month later, we feel very differently. And emotions, in a way, are the opposite of intellect, rationality, which is very consistent and very stable and doesn't change and doesn't fluctuate. But as we know, you know, emotion, passion, that's a very integral part of our service of Hashem. And the question is, how do we like engage our emotions, engage our passions, and like experience that excitement and that passion, and without letting it just dissipate and disappear and fall away? Because again, often when that happens, when we have these, you know, very passionate, fiery emotions, and then they dissipate, it can kind of feel like the whole thing wasn't real. The whole thing was imaginary almost. And one of the things that this mimer is going to be exploring is we're going to be exploring the story of the butler who forgets about Yosef, right, in the previous parsha, at the end of the previous parsha. And then as a result, we have this whole episode with Pare and his dreams, and then Yosef has to come and interpret those dreams. And we're going to explore this whole storyline on a mystical level, and sort of what that parallels in terms of our own Abaydus Hashem. We're going to go through each character, each element of the storyline, and sort of show the parallels of all of these in a spiritual way. And we're going to come to is going to kind of answer this question of like, how do we engage in the emotional side of our service Hashem in a way that it actually remains permanent and lasting and isn't just this fleeting experience that you know, disappears with time. And what we're going to come to at the end, which maybe we'll just start with this, is we have this imagery in Pare's dream where there's the seven fat cows, and we have the seven skinny cows, and then the seven thin cows, they swallow the seven fat cows, and it's as though the seven fat cows never existed, right? It's like, it's as if they never swallowed anything, right? They remain just as thin and sickly looking as they always were, and swallowing those fat cows, they disappear, right? As if they have no impact, which is, again, is sort of an imagery of this exact idea, right? Where we know that the number seven in general parallels the midais. There are seven midais, seven emotions, and the fat, like, right, these very robust cows, those represent like these very powerful, intense spiritual emotions, right? These positive, holy emotions. And then they get swallowed up by the skinny cows, right? They get swallowed up by our very mundane, materialistic, you know, physical desires and pleasures and you know, petty emotions. And they disappear as if they never existed, right? And we can all relate to that experience where you can feel very passionate, very excited, very inspired. And then a week later, you know, you just get caught up in, you know, the everyday concerns of life or other, you know, self-centered desires. And it almost feels as if those moments of inspiration never happened, right? It's as if they didn't exist at all. And that's sort of like the metaphor of this dream. And the question is, how do we avoid that? How do we avoid that state of mind, which this dream represents? What's the solution to that? So our answer is going to be, well, the reason why that happened, the reason why we had this occurrence of Pare's dream was because the butler forgot about Yosef, right? Which is, again, the end of the previous parsha, which leads directly into our parsha. And what we're going to be exploring is, what is the butler, right? What does the butler do, and what does that represent in our Avodas Hashem? Who is Yosef that the butler should have remembered, right? What's that quality of Yosef that we all need to remember in order to not get to that state of mind of Pare's dream, of those skinny cows swallowing the fat cows, and then they disappear as if they never were. So that's going to be sort of the agenda for this mimer. Okay, so So like I said, the mimer is going to be going through the storyline like step by step and sort of explaining each thing one at a time. Each character, each element, each, you know, part of the story, step by step. So let's start from the beginning. So he begins, Vihi miket shnasayim yamim upari chalam b'gemer. So it was after 2 years and Pari dreamed a dream. Okay, and this is where it describes this dream of the seven cows. Now, this parsha is a direct continuation. It's connected to the parsha that comes right before it. Right, the very end of the last week's parsha was that the butler did not remember Yosef. Right, he didn't remember what Yosef had said to him, which was, "Please, you know, after Yosef had interpreted his dream, and he said, please, you know, beg for mercy on my behalf." And the butler forgot once he got out of prison. So what's sort of the meaning of what's sort of the link between these two parshas? Because the butler did not remember Yosef, that's why we had this reality of at the end of 2 years, Pari having this dream and all that represents. Okay, so now let's start getting into what do all the pieces of the story mean? Like, who's Pari? Who's the butler? Who's Yosef? Right? What do all these things? What's this all about? So just like there's a person, Pari, right, and this butler, and they exist in this klipa state, like there's also opposite to that, right, because Hashem created everything in opposites, right, where there's both whatever exists in Kedusha also exists in Klipa. So just like that, those characters exist in Klipa, also on the side of Kedusha, we also have these same levels, these same dimensions. So what are they? Okay, so to explain that, we're going to start by talking about the four fundamental elements, right? So vihina yesh dalad yasaides, but nefesh adam, right? So there's four fundamental elements, fire, wind, water, and dust. And those also exist within the character of the person, right? So it's not just physical substances, but also elements of the person's character. So what are they? You said eish mishkan, I believe. So what's the foundation of fire, right? That fundamental element of fire that exists, that rests or dwells in the heart. Umakar halechas mehamayach shesham hu mishkan yisad hamayim, right? And because the source of moisture comes from the brain, not sure exactly what that means, that's where the element of water rests. Okay, so water is it's main space that it locates in the body is the mind, fire is in the heart. Okay, we're just gonna be discussing those two elements right now. We're not gonna be discussing ruach and afar. So now we're going to talk about, so what's the link between these two organs of the body, the mind and the heart? So the lung draws all kinds of liquid from the brain through the windpipe, and that's how it cools down the heat of the heart. Okay, so I guess you could say, I'm not so familiar with biology here, but like, in some way, the windpipe is like this connecting point between the head and the heart, and it allows there to be this sort of flow of oxygen and, you know, whatever else needs to go between them. And we're going to be sort of exploring both on a psychological level and on a spiritual level what that link is about. Okay, so just so far, we've been talking more on like in terms of the physical, the biological structure of the body. The kach b'nefesh elikis. So similarly, we have the same dynamic going on with the nefesh elikis, right? So what is the mayim and the ish? What's this water and the fire within the nefesh elikis? You said hamayim b'mayach. So the element of water is in the mind. What is that about? He bechinas chachma v'das v'avedes Hashem b'mayichim v'shavtai. It's all about our knowledge and our understanding within our avodas Hashem, where we use our minds, right? So water in general represents the intellectual side of our avodas Hashem. And now he's going to give a little bit of like an example of like, what does that mean? What does it mean to use our minds to serve Hashem? So he's going to go on like a little bit of a tangent to talk about like, how do we do that, right? What's an example of how someone might use their mind in their relationship with Hashem? So af kelis moshe tefisa beklal. Okay. So I feel like the question and answer that he brings up here is like a very common challenge people have to this whole notion that we as human beings can and should pursue the knowledge and understanding of Hashem, right? And I think as like a teacher in the classroom, I encounter this a lot with students, right? Where you ask a philosophical question about Hashem, like why would Hashem do this? Or how is it possible that Hashem could be this way or could do that or whatever? And often there's sort of this cop-out sort of attitude of like, well, we can't understand Hashem anyway, right? Hashem is beyond understanding. Hashem is beyond logic. So we can't understand Hashem. So why are we trying to figure this out? Why are we trying to answer these questions? Like, these questions are unanswerable, right? And indeed, there is a source for that, right? We say, no thought can grasp Hashem at all, right? So it's true, right? No thought can grasp him. So why should we try to use our minds? Again, we can use our minds to study halacha, right? We can use our minds to study what Torah says, but to understand Hashem himself, like that's not what we're capable of doing. So why should we even go there, right? So the response is halak siv, but it also says neida basharim baila. So this is a pasuk from, we say this in Eishes Chayil, right? Which literally means that her husband, right, the woman of Eishes Chayil, her husband is known by the gates. But the Zohar translates this a little bit differently, which is that Neida Basharim Baila. So Baila refers to Hashem, right? Our, you know, husband, as a Jewish people, our husband is Hashem. And Basharim means like in measure, or like the word shear, right? So how is our husband, Hashem, known? Basharim, like in a measured way, each person according to their own measure, right? So the Zohar says, Kol Chal Defum Shear Jodai, each person according to their own measure, according to what their mind is able to handle. The Hainu, meaning meaning that every person is capable of, you know, meditating and thinking about the greatness of Hashem. Lamaila adin keitz, lamata adin tachlis, that he is infinite beyond, you know, expands everywhere and is infinitely you know, transcendent above everything. There's nothing else besides him. Because by the breath of his mouth, you know, all creation is created. And everything is nothing before him. So we're giving sort of like a little very, very short, abridged version of this idea that really, if you think about all of creation, everything that we know about the universe is all compared to Hashem's breath, right? Just like a person, you know, if you hear a person saying a couple of words, the words that they say in no way captures the entirety of who the person is and the full depth and richness and of the person's psyche. And similarly, right, just every whatever we observe of all of creation is so insignificant compared to Hashem himself. Right, and this is something which every single person, according to their own measure, meaning based on what, you know, whatever their mental capabilities are, has the ability to understand that and to think about that in whatever way they are capable. Right, every person can understand and grasp this idea that nothing else exists at all. Right, all of reality, both this, you know, spiritual and physical reality, are all coming just from Hashem's, the breath of Hashem's mouth. And this is sort of like an additional point, which means, and this is sort of like an allusion to what it says in Tanya, that you know, we often, you know, even in the Chumash, right, we talk about Hashem creating the world with the Asar Mamaris. So we often compare creation to Hashem's speech, and yet in Perakal Palav, the Atarba says that Hashem's speech is not the same as human speech in many ways, but in one obvious way is that when a person speaks, their words sort of emerge outside of them, and then other people can hear them and, you know, interpret them and do what they want with them, and they remain separate from the person. But obviously, because nothing exists outside of Hashem, Hashem's words remain within him, right? Which just gives us an even stronger appreciation or sort of sense of how insignificant all of creation really is. Because not only is it just like one word compared to the entire person, but it's those words themselves are still contained within, right? Within the person, right? It's like the words that you say before you actually say them while they're still within your own mind, which really have no significance relative to their source, which is really what all of creation is. So therefore, like everything literally really has no significance compared to Hashem. So this is something, again, this is all just an example of what it means to use our minds to serve Hashem, which is, again, all a illustration of what this mayim, right, the element of water is within the nefesh elikis. Okay, so now we're going to get to, okay, so what's this element of fire? B'yisayit ha'esh, who had siman shabalev ha'mevin b'espanis b'gdol tzeis barach, right? So once you've already like sort of thought about this idea and really sort of, you know, it really resonates with you, then you develop this thirst in your heart. Once you've already understood these ideas, v'ich mamash kli kamech l'kshivi, right? You already understood how everything is insignificant compared to Hashem. V'lazais, and therefore, kolsa nafshe elav yisparach ba'ava aza karish be'esh shal hevas ha'olam ayala liskal bar Hashem v'yichudi yisparach, right? There's going to be this like yearning of the soul towards Hashem with this very powerful love, just like these flaming, you know, these flames of fire that are, you know, automatically rise up and want to be included within their source, within Hashem. Right? And like the desire, the person naturally is not going to want to be like stuck in this down here in this physical world. We can kind of see, right? We can kind of appreciate why fire would be sort of the representation of this love, because the same way fire naturally is drawn upward, that sort of parallels how this experience, this emotional experience, is very much this feeling of yearning to return upward to our source. Okay, Masha'in Kane b'chinas ha'mayim hu l'malamana l'mata, right? But what's water? Water is kind of the other way around. It has the opposite tendency, where it's all about sort of flowing downward, right? Water is always going to go down to the lowest place, right? So fire is always rising up, while water is always coming down. So what is that? What we're sort of going to see here is that while the emotional part of the person, the emotional side of the nefesh elikis, its nature is always to sort of be yearning, right? Trying to leave, trying to escape the constraints of the world. The nature of the mind, the nature of the intellectual side of the nefesh elikis is always to sort of be aligned with the truth, aligned with like what our purpose is, and therefore it's going to be more drawn downward, more drawn to what our purpose in this world is. Okay, so much ink and mechanism of mind, who the matzah. So just like, so as opposed to water, which is always flowing downward, shamayim yerdim makam gavaya lamakam namach, right? Water flows from a high place to a low place. So what's the sort of the symbolism of that? Dahani shamam shechanafshi ar Hashem zu tar mitzvahs, right? That this element of water is all about drawing down the light of Hashem through Torah mitzvahs into our soul, right? It's about sort of focusing on what's our mission, what's our purpose in the world through doing Torah mitzvahs. The higher al nashi gam b'yosi lamata b'fchinas al bakar ha'katachai, right? To kind of like shed light within our own soul while we're down here, this experience of like our purpose is to live, right? Against our will, we live, right? That even though we might have these, the soul might naturally be tending to want to yearn to escape this world, but our real mission is to be down here. Okay, so the kamaisha mayim achabnasi. So now we're going to sort of extend this metaphor and say, just like water extinguishes fire, right? That's its nature. Kach ayadeze yirabitim anashe. So similarly, like when we like evoke the water part of the nefesh elikis, that actually quenches the thirst of the fire, right? So when we're in this very emotional state, it's this very strong, powerful thirst and yearning, like wanting to be closer to Hashem. But that once we like sort of bring out the mind, bring out that sense of like purpose, that sense of like mission in this world, that and the fact that Torah mitzvahs can actually accomplish that, it can actually like bring us the ultimate connection with Hashem, that ends up being this sort of this way of quenching that thirst and that desire for Hashem.
It almost sounds like water represents a certain stability. Mm. And so when we're feeling unstable or we're not feeling like secure, then we're seeking out all this like emotional connection. And that's what we need to feel safe, versus when we're in a very stable kind of place, you don't need all that tension and excitement, right. Because you're already feeling very, very secure.
Right. Yeah. Like the Torah mitzvahs are sort of the key to creating that stable, like framework of connection. Yeah. Grounded connection. That's very real. I mean, it's almost like the fire is like this sense of like, almost coming from a sense of distance, like I'm yearning for something that I don't have, while the Torah mitzvahs is like, oh no, here's a way of actually getting that connection that I'm looking for. Yeah. Okay. Kamai Shikasav have a cult sama lekula maim, Kushna's bar makam acher, right? Like it says that whoever is thirsty, let them go to the water, right? Which means that water is a tyra, which is a way that we can quench our thirst for Hashem. Okay, so now what's this bridge, right? How do we bridge the world of the mind and the world of the heart, the world of water and the world of fire, which, by the way, also, you know, water in general is like, you know, fire is naturally hot and water is cold, which again is another way of sort of understanding this connection between water and the mind and fire and the heart, right? That, you know, the mind is naturally cold, you know, less passionate, less, you know, fiery in the way that the heart is. Okay, so how do we link these two? Right. So how do we connect these two worlds? It's through the windpipe. Okay, the windpipe is this the bridge between the mind and the heart. Right. So what does that mean? That windpipe represents the source of the letters of Torah. Right, we know that it says in Mishlei, right, that you can acquire chachma and acquire bina, but the word kene can also sounds like the word kana, right, which is this windpipe that connects the brain and the heart. So that is the sahar mashkim. That's what the butler represents. The butler is sort of this intermediary that allows the mind and heart to connect and allows the mind. The Torah that's sort of housed in the mind to quench the thirst of the heart. So he says Shabai Sheyev Harea Mashke Melechas Hamayach Misat Hamayim Shabai. Right, that's how the lung is able to draw out liquid from the moisture in the brain, which is coming from the element of water. Okay, so in other words, what was all of this all about, right? This entire section was just about trying to explain to us what the Sahar HaMashkim represents in Kedusha, right? Or in other words, within our own Nefesh HaLekis, within our own Avodas Hashem, Sahar HaMashkim is this ability to bridge the gap between the mind and the heart and bring that, bring the truth of Torah into our lives to quench that thirst. Okay, so now we're going to talk about how do we see that in, like, practically what a butler does, right? A butler is somebody who, you know, they squeeze the grapes to turn it to get out the wine. And then they, right, serve it, in this case, serving it to Pari in order to drink. So how do we see this idea within what a butler actually does? Okay, so the next piece here is V'zeu inyan hachalem shel sahar hamashkim. So now we can understand the dream of the butler. V'hinei gefen lefanei, because he describes how there was a vine before me, v'ashchad es ha'anavim, and I squeezed out the grapes, v'etan es ha'kais ha'kalf pari, and then I put the cup on the in Pari's hand, right? So we're going to explain what's the vine, what are the grapes, what does it mean to squeeze the grapes, and what does it mean to give it to Pari? So what does it mean to put it into a cup and to give it to Pari? We're going to explain each of these elements. So Pirish, Gefen Nikkakarsis Yisrael. So in general, the Jewish people are referred to as a vine. Okay, we're compared to a vine. She Klalas Chonoshamas Yisrael, right? So the vine is like the global body of the entire Jewish nation, right? All the collective of souls all together. But in each individual grape is each individual neshama, is like a grape. Shekol nisis nikra b'shem anav echad, right? Each individual spark of an neshama is referred to as a grape. Ki b'chol nitzas yish b'chines, okay, so why is it called a grape? Why is every neshama referred to as a grape? Ki b'chol nitzas yish b'chines yayin ha-masemech alekim b'anashim. Because every single neshama includes within it wine. So what's wine? So we bring this pasuk from Shoftim that says, yayin ha-masemech alekim b'anashim, wine that brings joy to Hashem and to people. Okay, so what does that mean? What is that wine that brings joy to Hashem and to people? Shubachinas ha'ava misuteris. That's this hidden, latent love that every single Jew has. L'smayach b'Hashem, that leads us to this rejoicing in Hashem. B'hi Yerushalayim Avosenu, and this love is something which is an inheritance to us from our forefathers. So what are we saying here? So Jewish people as a whole are referred to as a vine. Each individual grape is each neshama, and contained within that grape, contained within that neshama, is this wine. Wine represents this hidden love that all of us have. And the same way that wine brings joy to people, that hidden love of that exists within our neshama allows us to rejoice in our relationship with Hashem. Okay, but this love, Elohim Shehimas Sutaras Ma'id, it's very hidden, right? It's very concealed. Kamayayan Hanitzman Ba'anavim, right? Just like wine is very much hidden inside the grape. Sha'anav Hu Agal V'chalak U'makav Asim Kol'tad, right? If you just look at a grape, it's round and it's smooth and it's, right, the skin surrounds the juice inside from all sides. V'yashir L'hayti Eimimenu Yayin Ki'im Ayri Schita U'dricha Begas L'hasir Me'al V'klipa Hazav V'zeisei. The only way that you can extract the wine from this grape is through squeezing out the grape in a wine press in order to remove the skin that surrounds it. So what does that mean in terms of our this love that every neshama has? Right? Similarly, we can only reveal this hidden love through the avaida of mevachin, right? So what does mevachin mean? Mevachin literally means to crush, right? Or to break. So this is sort of a reference to it. The Zohar talks about, gives this metaphor that just like if you have a very thick piece of wood and it's not catching on fire, you should, you know, splinter it into very small pieces and then it will catch on fire. And he says, similarly, a person, right? Literally says like a body, right? A human being who isn't able to, like, they're not able to inspire themselves and ignite their soul with this love of Hashem. What's the solution? Is to break down the person, right? Like sort of shatter them in some way, emotionally, psychologically, in order to like allow that inspiration, allow that fire of love to ignite. So here he gets a very interesting, what does that mean, Mavachan? Like, how do you do that practically? What does it mean to actually, to break ourselves, right? How do we do that? So what he suggests here is, Hevi shval ruch b'fnei kol adam. What's the solution? Is humbling ourselves before every person. Like, how do we break away that covering that's like not allowing us access to this love that we naturally all have, or what's going to allow us to take that away is by sort of approaching other people with a sense of humility. Not that we wait for other people to humble us, right? So very often people will do things that diminish our ego, right? And sometimes we have the humility to take it as like in a way that it humbles us, and sometimes we don't. But here he's saying, even if you don't have to wait for that, right? We don't have to wait for other people to trigger this humility within us. But kiyim behevi shval ruach, right? Hevi shval ruach means that you should be shval ruach, right? You should feel low, right? You should sort of lower yourself before other people. Hevi b'asmecha, you on your own, right? V'nafshi k'afra l'kotia ka'as kufa hanedreses, right? Or soul, like, the person should see their soul as dust, like a doorstep that's being stepped on. In order to remove this foreskin, right, that's surrounding the heart. So I think just to stop here for a second, this isn't going to be like the main. Although the Marmer is going to continue talking about this a little bit more, and there's going to be another section here, which we're actually not going to read inside, but we'll discuss a little bit outside, which is also going to talk about this idea a little bit, this concept of humbling ourselves in order to open ourselves up to receive something greater, right? Open ourselves up to a reality beyond ourselves. And I think that sometimes this, especially for sure the language here, can feel like contrary to our modern sensibilities. So maybe it's worth like discussing a little bit.
It sounds like, oh, let people step on
yeah,
you.
That's literally what it says. Yeah.
What it sounds like. Yeah.
So I feel like it requires a little bit of like a translation into like, how do we do this in a way that's productive and not like just crushing ourselves in a way that's counterproductive, right?
Right. Well, in Tanya, when he speaks about being Shval Ruach, the Alter Rebbe discusses how really it begins with recognizing that we don't actually know the origins of other people. We don't know their complete story. We cannot fully be in their place. And therefore, there is space for humility before every person, because you have no clue what their story is, what they've been through. It's really, the focus is almost on like a lack of judgment of other people and not automatically looking at someone and being like, oh, I'm better than them, or I can do this, why can't they? but this recognition of like really anyone can be better than me. There's no space for judgment for any person, and therefore I need to have like respect for every person. So I don't think it's so much about so much reflecting upon me and how I am lower than them, but more about creating space for other people to be. And that automatically humbles myself because I'm not constantly thinking about me and pitting them against me. It's creating it almost creates like a more neutral space automatically.
Yeah. I think that's really interesting to hear. Like the starting point is your approach to other people. Like not, yeah, exactly. Like you said, not so much about crushing our own ego or like putting ourselves down or thinking less of our own qualities or capabilities. But, you know, if we could start to develop this genuine admiration and respect for other people, it naturally opens us up to not being so stuck in ourselves, to not being so, you know, confined to our own ego. And it's sort of like, it's almost like a healthier way to go about it, because it's, again, focus less on ourselves and more focused on how we're opening ourselves up to other people. And in general, in Chassidus, we talk about this idea of our relationship with other people being a gateway to our relationship with Hashem. So like the more we can develop a sense of humility, a sense of respect, a sense of openness to other people, naturally that translates into our relationship with Hashem as well.
I think in modern parenting, a popular concept is to always like look for the best interpretation. Mm. And as in, right, when there's like a behavior that is that maybe we don't view as so positive, how can I maybe spin this into a positive interpretation? Like, you know, a child is being very stubborn and strong-minded. So how can I possibly twist this into have a positive, create a space where it's not that they're being malicious, but rather that, you know, they have a strong sense of what they want, and that can play out positively in the future, not necessarily allowing that behavior to continue, but finding that positive interpretation. And I think something that I've noticed personally is that the more I'm feeling myself, the harder it is to find a positive interpretation. The deeper you are within yourself and my feelings and how I feel about this, it's very difficult to find positive interpretations, because I'm always going to take everything as being an attack against me. And this is not just with parenting. I think this is with all relationships that, you know, I think with, you'll find this a lot with, in with spouse, with your friends, that the more you're wallowing in yourself, the more you interpret things negatively that other people are doing. And the more we get out of ourselves and we sort of let go of ourselves and again, enter into like maybe a more neutral space, then we're able to find a positive interpretation. So I think that's also like an interesting way to think about, you know, lowering yourself before other people means maybe just like leaving my deep, constant feeling of how I'm affected, how I feel, and going into a space where then I can have, where it's possible to have respect for other people, because it's very hard to respect other people when you're deep inside yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, and I just want to like point out, like, I feel like the interpretation, like you said, like, sometimes we can, I feel like it has to be genuine, you know, like, sometimes we can, like, we can sort of tell ourselves a mantra in our head of, like, oh, they really have a positive right. intent, but we don't actually believe it, you know, because if we're in that space of, like, being stuck in ourselves, then we can, like, you know, do the, yeah, like, tell ourselves, oh, yeah, they probably mean something good, you know, have a positive intent, but it's not really going to be our natural experience, as opposed to when we're able to like get out of ourselves and sort of just be in that curious open space, naturally we see it differently, you know? Okay. So just to, summarize, so I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. The conclusion of this piece talking all about this idea of the wine and squeezing the grape and, you know, the avaid, you know, the avaida of the Sar HaMashkim and all of that. He continues on to talk about this idea of, right, we sort of reference this idea of Arla, right? And in general, we have this concept of circumcising the heart, right? You know, and sort of the metaphor is that, you know, every person has a layer, right? Like a layer of skin, so to speak, right? Something which is sort of like, sometimes it can be even this very, very subtle, very, very, you know, not necessarily overtly evil, but something, a part of us, like a certain level of investment in selfish pursuits or in materialism, or, you know, a certain obsession with our own personal agenda that blocks us from being able to really have full access to our Avodas Hashem, to Hashem, to like experiencing Hashem in our lives. And part of our, the squeezing of the grape, again, just like the grape physically, right? The skin falls away. That's like, you know, the same, it's sort of a similar idea, this idea of like circumcising the heart, right? Like removing that, those blockages, removing those parts of, and again, these aren't necessarily bad. It's not necessarily somebody who's like done something wrong or evil or anything like that, but even just like that natural self-centeredness, that natural, you know, tendency to be self-absorbed, being able to remove that is like sort of a precondition to fully accessing that inner love for Hashem. The next piece after that, he gets into this idea that wine, I guess you could say, has two functions, right? People use wine as a way of just rejoicing, right? Celebrating, right? It's a way of bringing joy to people. But wine is also used to get into, become intoxicated, right? Which is in a way not not just like bringing joy, but sort of escaping reality in a certain sense. And we actually see this in the when somebody would be sentenced to death by the Beis Din, they would give them, before they would be executed, they would give them a cup of wine, right? They would intoxicate them, basically, so that they would lose their mind. And again, it was sort of like a way of making it a more, you know, less painful death, because at least psychologically they weren't in a state of mind where they can really fully be aware of what was happening to them. So it would be less psychologically, you know, fearful, you know, scary and painful and all that. So what is this idea of drinking this? So again, we see this when it comes practically, right, in the times of the Beis Din, when they would actually they would actually execute people. But we also have this concept of the Arba Mises Beis Din, right? The four different methods of you know, applying the death penalty at the times of the Beis Din. We have that, we have like a spiritual Mises Beis Din that we actually describe in Kriyat Shema Shalemita. We sort of go through each of these and how each of them are sort of, there's sort of like a spiritual process we can go through to spiritually afflict on ourselves these Mises Beis Din as a way of rectifying things that we've done wrong. So the idea here is that this wine, right, really there's two functions of this wine that the Sahar Mashkin brings. One function is for when people are in a state of a more pure state, right, where all they need to do in order to access that hidden love for Hashem is to just remove that skin, right, remove that extra layer of like self-centeredness in order to access that inner wine. But for people who have actually been involved in things that have really distanced themselves from Hashem, right? Like actual sins, actual things that have really created this real barrier in their relationship. For them, they need not just the Yayin HaMasameach, but the Yayin HaMashaker, right? The wine that actually makes us drunk, right? What does drunk mean? Drunk means allowing us to escape from the reality, from the mindset that we were in before, and completely let go of that mindset. And that happens also through a certain type of crushing, right? So he describes also like the sense of like real bitterness, really feeling pained by our distance from Hashem. And that is a process that allows us to sort of return and access, once again, access that love for Hashem that we naturally have. So that's sort of the next sort of couple of paragraphs here sort of talks about that idea, right? This idea that there could be both this Yayin HaMasameach and Yayin HaMashaker, which are just two different pathways by which we access this hidden love. Okay, so we're going to skip ahead to where it says Ach Eid Achas. Okay, and here he's going to start getting into sort of the conclusion, which is, number one, what does it mean to place that wine into the cup, into Pari's cup? And then finally, going back to the very beginning, why is it that forgetting about Yosef, and what does Yosef represent? And why is it that forgetting about Yosef is what, why is it that the Sahar HaMashkim, forgetting about Yosef, is what's going to lead to Pari's dreams? Okay. So ach ein achas hitzarch lisist itzis banashe bebeis bechines yain. So there's one more one more thing that the person has to sort of advice the person has to take when they're going about these two pathways of these two different types of wine. Right? So we can understand this based on the Maamar Chazal that it says Hashem saw that the light was good, right? This is from Bereishis, the description of creation. And then Chazal say, Kitayv hu lignais. What does it mean that he saw the light was good? He saw that it was good. And because it was good, it should be hidden, right? He saw it was good to hide it. Okay, so what does it mean to hide? What that means is that anything which is really good, right, real, something that's really precious, has to be hidden, has to be protected in some way. Okay, Ubirian, yes, what does this mean? Kamaisha kasav bekashi es shahav adavshi, right? Like it says, I searched for what, for the one that my soul loves. Achastiv layar penu achahe visiv al bais imi ve'el chadar harasi. Right, this is all from Shir HaShirim. I held on to him. And I didn't feel healed, right? My love was not satisfied until I brought him into the house of my mother and the room of my parents. Let's just interpret what's this pasuk referring to? Beisimi zutar shabaksav, cheder harasi zutar shabapeh. So the house of my mother, this is a reference to tar shabaksav. The room of my parents is referenced to tar shabapeh. So what's this pasuk trying to say? Shehem bachinas kelim lahachnis besechem gili alikusi yisparach, that they are the vessels through which we bring the giloy of alikus, right? We bring about the revelation of alikus. So what's all this about? What this is saying is that really you can go through this whole process of, you know, removing the skin of the grape, right? Like getting rid of anything that's blocking our this natural love for Hashem, when we can access that inner wine, right? That love that we all innately have. But at the end of the day, there also needs to be somewhere that you put it, right? There needs to be a cup that you put the wine into, right? There needs to be some sort of a concrete vessel, a concrete a grounded way that I'm actually like giving giving expression to this experience, to this love that I have within real concrete ways. And that's what Torah is all about, right? Torah Shabbatav, Torah Shabbat, right? The mitzvahs that we do, these are all ways that we're actually finding a grounded expression of that natural love that the neshama has, right? So bechinas kais pari, that's what the cup of pari represents. K'may shekas of kais yeshu es esa, b'az miskai mayayin b'secha, right? Like it says, I will raise a cup of salvation. And that's how the wine is able to last. That's what gives the wine the stability, right? Going back to what we were talking about before, that what gives the emotional experience stability is the structure, the framework of Torah and mitzvahs. But if you get rid of those kelim, right? If you don't have those concrete vessels that to hold that light, to hold that that love for Hashem, then the light goes away, right? It doesn't last. It doesn't stay. Okay. So that's the first step. The first step is that this, what the Sar HaMashkin does, right? He has to, part of his job is not just to extract the wine, but to actually put it into a cup, right? To give it an actual vessel that can hold it and give it stability. But now we're going to say there's really another step. Ba'ayid yishkalai inyan ma'isav shalai yeh b'shvil atzmai ki'im la'tzis nachas ruch lefanav yisparach. But the next step is that when you're doing those actions, when you're giving your love concrete expression in some way, there needs to be this sense, this awareness that what I'm doing is not for myself. It's not just because like I have this passion, I have this excitement, I have this yearning and this desire, and in some way I'm quenching my own thirst, right? I'm giving myself, you know, in some way you could say I'm giving meaning or purpose to my life, right? Which again, as spiritual and lofty as it might sound, in some way is a way of fulfilling my own quest for completion and fulfillment. So that can't be the motivation for the action. But the goal has to be just to bring pleasure to Hashem. Right, to give him a dwelling place, give him a place where he can rest down here. That his light should dwell within the words of Torah, which are a vessel for his light. So what is Yosef? Yosef is exactly that idea, right? Yosef means to add, right? To bring, to add something. Like, what are we adding, so to speak, to Hashem? We're adding pleasure to Hashem himself, right? That's really what the motivation for our Torah mitzvahs has to be. Not just about our own, you know, personal fulfillment and our own personal agenda. Right, so that's why it says, right, the end of last week's parsha is the Tsar Hamashkin, the butler, did not remember Yosef. He forgot about him. And then Vihimikates, and then this whole story about Pari's dream happens. So what does that mean? Pirish, ki ayadesh v'lay zachar b'chines Yosef shehula harbis tanig l'fanis baruch, meaning that by way of him forgetting about Yosef, which what is Yosef? Yosef is this awareness that our whole purpose of doing Torah mitzvahs is all about bringing pleasure to Hashem. So through that, this av al yedei zev v'yihi miketz, that's what brought about this reality of v'yihi miketz. So now we're going to analyze that pasuk a little bit, right? V'yihi miketz shnasayim shana. So the word miketz means the end, right? L'shain saif v'tichla, right? L'b'china shnasayim yami. It's the end of those 2 years. Pirush, meaning sheyich l'chas v'sholom etzlei b'china zatera. That this person, right, who's forgetting about Yosef, forgetting about what the true motivation for his Torah mitzvahs should be, they're going to lose, they're going to come to an end of their relationship to Torah. So how do we see that Torah is represented by these words, Shnasayim Yamim, right? Shehu b'chinas Shnasayim Yamim, that Torah is represented by Shnasayim Yamim. Kamash Kasav, like it says, Ve'ayesh Hashum Yamim Yamim, that we have this concept that the Torah precedes the world by 2,000 years. So in our pasuk it says 2 years, but it's sort of this parallel to this concept in general of Torah being compared to 2,000 years, preceding the world by 2,000 years. And we also see, we see in the Tikkuni Zayar that this idea as well, that again, not necessarily in a chronological way, but in terms of its transcendence above the world, the wisdom of Torah is precedes the world in terms of its loftiness, right? Where do we see that? It says Chakim b'lei b'chach miyadiyah, Mevim b'lei b'vina yadiyah. That Hashem is wise, but not with a knowable wisdom, and Mevin and has the level of bina, but not in a knowable level of Bina, right? So Bina Yediyah and Chachma Yediyah are these levels of Chachma and Bina as they exist in our world. But Torah sort of reveals this level of Chachma and Bina that's beyond our world. So here we see this idea of there being two dimensions, right? Which is represented by the 2,000 years or the 2 years, these two dimensions of how of Torah that precede or transcend the world. So Bechinas Chachma Torah Shebaksav, right? The level of Chachma is Torah Shebaksav. Bechinas Bina Torah Shebapeh. Bina is Torah Shebapeh. So this person who is forgetting about Yosef, because his whole focus of his Avet Hashem, as great as it might be, is really focused on himself. So he's not going to be as concerned. He's not going to be as focused on ensuring that he's hiding this light, he's protecting this light by putting it into a vessel, by giving it a concrete form. But it'll be enough for him just to reveal that light in tefillah, meaning just to have an emotional experience, but not to actually give it a concrete expression in his life. So what's going to happen as a result of that? What happens when we don't remember Yosef, when we don't have the proper focus, a proper motivation in our avida, and therefore we end up coming to the end of the two years. So what happens eventually? We come to the state of parai having a dream. Right? That even when we do reveal this wine, right, this hidden love that we all have, they're not going to be real, right? They're not going to be really lasting and authentic. Right? They're just going to be like imaginary, like a dream. And it's just going to, right, the light, this love that we had is just going to, you know, fall away. Right, and then we have this, right, what happens when the light of Torah goes away? We no longer have that, the mind, right, the seichel of Torah sort of grounding the experience of the emotions. Then you're left with just the midas. And then once it's just midas, right, it's just your own emotional experience that's not focused by anything that transcends it. That's when you have this reality of, right, what's described in Paru's dream. We have the seven, you know, good fat cows, and then afterwards comes the lean cows, and then they swallow them up, and it's as if you can't even tell that they were ever swallowed. What does that mean? Pirish and nistalik v'nisalim ha'ar kol kach achanedim alek yilu leis balam elam, right? The light, right, that passion, that excitement, like, disappears to the extent that it's as if, you know, he never had that experience of passionate davening at all. But when we do have that level of Yosef, that our focus is not about our own experience, but about how we're bringing pleasure to Hashem, to make for Hashem this, you know, a space where he can dwell in our world. So at that point, once a person has that focus coming from the level of Yosef, then their midas, even they're for sure not going to have the negative emotions, right? The emotions that are completely self-centered, but even their emotions towards Hashem are not going to be coming from this like natural, like sort of self-driven desire for fulfillment or inspiration or whatever it is, but any emotions that the person does experience are not going to be sort of a personal experience, but just a natural expression of their nefesh halakis, a natural expression of their awareness or their sense of what Hashem wants or what Hashem needs. And of course, there's going to be no evil that's going to emerge from that place. But the good that exists within him, that natural love, will be protected and hidden and kept sacred through that, through the remembering that level of Yosef. So just to conclude here, I think this is an idea that, you know, we have this in relationships in general, right? Where when you're in a relationship with another person, there's a part of it that's selfish in the sense that you are, right, if it's a relationship that, like a real, a meaningful relationship, right, then you want to be part of this relationship. There's something you're getting out of it. There's something that you're, right, in some way it's filling something inside of you by being in this relationship. And at the same time, by necessity, if it's a relationship that's really, you're really committed to, there's also a sense of selflessness, right? Where there's a sense of like real giving and devotion to the other person that's not just about you. And I think the danger of a relationship where it's driven by my own self-fulfillment, by what it's filling within myself, as opposed to what I'm contributing, what am I giving, how am I committing to the other, is that like eventually, right, when that's sort of like the framework by which I'm functioning in the relationship, it becomes very shaky, becomes very unstable, right? Because it means that I'm only engaged in a relationship as long as it's filling something for me, as long as it feels fulfilling, it feels engaging, it feels enriching in my personal experience. And that's sort of the message of this mimer, I think, is that, you know, we can go through this whole process and we're outlining this whole journey that we go through in order to develop this rich relationship with Hashem, right? To both develop this emotional connection, but also ground it in our entire mitzvahs. But at the end of the day, that whole journey, that whole relationship that we're building has to be driven not at its core, not by ourselves, not by our own personal agenda, but by how we're showing up for Hashem in the relationship. And actually, just to connect this to Hanukkah, being that it is Hanukkah, is we actually have a similar concept with the menorah, right? That the menorah in the Beis Hamikdash was seven branches, where again, we had that number seven, the seven midais. And we see that Aaron HaKohen, when he's lighting the menorah, he lights, right? He lights each of the seven candles and with oil, right? And oil in general, we know is a symbol of chachma, right? Chachma being this concept of bittul, this concept of devotion, openness, and real being able to approach something not from our own personal perspective, but for what that thing is, right? Being devoted to the truth as it is, not as it relates to me or as it, you know, shows up in my experience. And the whole idea of lighting the menorah is bringing that chachma, bringing that sense of bittul, bringing that sense of humility, that sense of devotion beyond myself, into the midas, into our emotions, into the emotional experience, so that we can have that emotion and that passion and that inspiration, but it can be driven by the sense of commitment, the sense of humility to something that's higher than myself. And that's what allows them to really last, right? That's what allows that inspiration to not just be fleeting and not just, be transient based on how I'm feeling on that day, but it gives a real consistency and a real groundedness to that emotional experience.